It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope you'll rate, review, and subscribe to this one, but of course, only if you like what you hear. Fred Flights is going to join us today. He is currently the vice chairman of the America First Policy Institute Center for American Security. He previously served as the chief of staff and executive secretary of the National Security Council from May through October of 2018 during President Trump's administration. He's a former CIA analyst and an expert on foreign policy and national security. We talked to him about the Ukraine situation and how we ought to view it and interpret it through the lens of the past several decades of experience, particularly post the 2014 incursion in Crimea. We also had a conversation with John Davidson, senior editor at The Federalist. He has been writing about the Ukraine issue and the assorted assessments of what Vladimir Putin's aims are with this incursion, how we should view it through the lens of expansionist efforts in Russia's recent past. We talked to both of these guests at length about Ukraine and Russia and this current war. I hope that you will listen with interest. Fred Flights coming up next.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
Fred, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Good to be here.
I want to talk to you about the situation as it stands currently in Ukraine. But before we get into that, let's back up a step. In terms of looking at the policy toward Ukraine on the United States' part, since the 2014 incursion that we saw under the Obama administration, how have things shifted and changed? And in particular, what changed under the Trump administration beginning in 2017?
I think that's an interesting question because we all know how strongly Donald Trump was criticized for being soft on Russia and for him and his campaign colluding with Russia. But in fact, Trump had a pretty strong Russia policy, imposed some very tough sanctions against the Russians, sent lethal aid to Ukraine. But he had another approach to Russia that I think was very stabilizing. And that is, Mr. Trump understood that we have to coexist with the Russians. We may not like what they're doing. We may find a lot of what they're doing morally repellent, but it is a nation with the largest nuclear arsenal on Earth, and we have to somehow find a way to coexist with them. Now, Biden, by contrast, has been clueless in every possible way, seems to think that by name-calling and drawing red lines for the Russians and threatening them with sanctions that the Russians going to ignore, that would somehow change Russian behavior. It would get them to do what we want. Well, this didn't work. And I think in addition, Biden has also tried to appease Russia by taking sanctions off the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And then with the foreign policy failures, especially the withdrawal from Afghanistan, and an unserious, frivolous foreign policy that's been based on climate change. Putin has seen weakness. He's seen the United States that doesn't respect him, the weakest foreign policy in history, an incredibly incompetent U.S. president. And I think that created a series of events that led Putin to decide that this was the time to invade Ukraine.
So one of the aspects of this that I hear voiced by people who either, I won't smear them by saying they are Putin defenders. What I would say they are is that they defend Putin's rationale as being logical or justified given the eastward expansion of NATO. My own response to that would be that Putin has shown us time and again that he is interested in re-achieving the what was lost when the Soviet Union broke up, that he has been nothing but expansionist in multiple examples, and that this is not something that, you know, is it, that while Ukraine reacted to the 2014 incursion by certainly adding it to their priority list to join, you know, the European Union and to join NATO, that in reality NATO was not considering that seriously in any real way prior to this latest incursion. So who has the better of that argument? Is it somewhere in between? And do you think any of this justification for you know, NATO expanded and that threatened Putin, and so this was something he had to do to react, does that really make any sense?
I don't completely agree with that argument. First of all, Ukraine is clearly a separate nation, a separate nationality, but within Russia and the Soviet Union, that's been disputed for hundreds of years. It isn't simply something that Putin came up with. I don't think it's a sensible argument that the Ukrainians are Russians, but that is something that Putin seems to earnestly believe and the Ukrainians reject. I do think Putin is threatened by a democratic Ukraine. He's threatened by the prospect of Western culture getting so close to Russia, the prospect of NATO forces being placed in Ukraine. I think that his fears about this threatening Russia were frankly paranoid. They certainly didn't justify invading Ukraine and killing what at least thousands of people, it could be many, many more. Mm-hmm. On the part of the West, I think it would have been better if we had somehow found a way to deal with this issue without being so in your face with Putin. Mm-hmm. I mean, when things started heating up, it was time to stop talking about NATO membership for Ukraine, even though you and I know that isn't going to happen because it would have taken a unanimous vote by all 30 members of NATO. But yes, we kept saying the door is open. We have an open door policy. And I think we were irritating Putin unnecessarily. And I'm not blaming the West, but I'm just saying that we have to find a different way to deal with it.
The irony, of course, of this situation is that it has now restarted a lot of different conversations related to NATO that critics who say that it's been too weak or, you know, have been bringing up for quite a while. Germany, the reversal of German policy, the conversation that seems to be already happening among the Finns and the Swedes, perhaps as well, joining NATO. Is this a situation where, you know, regardless of the ultimate outcome in Ukraine, you actually have the effect of unifying and perhaps strengthening and maybe even expanding NATO due to this incursion?
I think all of those things are true, and it's just remarkable. Look at how Germany suddenly wants to spend the amount on its military that it is supposed to under its NATO commitment. Donald Trump fought with them so hard on it. I went to the NATO summit in Brussels with President Trump. You probably saw that historic picture where all the NATO members are sitting around scowling.
I love that picture.
Has his hands full. This is leadership. This is the president saying, this is what we're going to do, and you're wrong. And it took a lot of guts. We would never see that kind of leadership out of Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. And it looks like the Swedes and the Finns are now seriously considering coming to NATO. Putin has invigorated NATO, and he's encouraged other states to join it. And you know, I think this may worsen relations. It probably will worsen relations between NATO and Russia. But you have to think it's going to undermine Putin's standing in Russia, among the Russian elite, among Russian military officials and senior government officials. I don't know if there's any way they could overthrow him, but I can't imagine that they think this was a good approach for him to take.
Talk to us about the, you know, insular nature of Putin. This is something I've heard a lot from media commentators, including many I trust. They say that he's grown more isolated, that he's listening to these people around him who maybe didn't give him an accurate picture of what Ukraine was like now, that it was based more on their experience back in 2014, when, you know, in the time since, more than 400,000 people have cycled through the Donbass region, you know, that Ukraine's military is much stronger now, perhaps, than it was then. tell me about that. Is your perspective that sort of Putin was operating here with a full set of information, or did he kind of run into the teeth of unexpected problems? Is it just yes men? What's going on there?
It's funny. One of your Fox colleagues called me about this morning, and she told me she heard Putin that doesn't use the internet and doesn't have a cell phone. Well, frankly, I don't think leaders like Putin and Trump and Biden should have cell phones. They're simply too vulnerable to foreign intelligence services. Donald Trump wouldn't listen, and who knows what foreign intelligence services picked up. That's a discussion for another day.
Yeah, we could do an hour on that, but go ahead.
whether he's on the internet or not, I don't know. I think he is surrounded by yes men. But I also believe, as a former KGB officer, he has a very different worldview. And when Condi Rice runs around saying he's crazy and he has an unrealistic view, he's changed his approach. I think Putin has had a Soviet view of the world his whole life, and this isn't something new. I don't doubt he's been more isolated because of the pandemic, and he is surrounded by yes men. But I wouldn't assume that he's not monitoring Western media, that he isn't hearing what's going on in the West. I just think he interprets it differently.
Mm-hmm. One example of that I heard brought up by a BBC NewsHour correspondent, Simon Ostrovsky, recently, was that he said the Russians had perhaps assessed the unpopularity of President Zelensky, who was quite unpopular in opinion polls in Ukraine, as being an indication that perhaps Ukrainians would support a regime change of sorts. But this, of course, is not the case. One's politicians can be unpopular regardless of whether you want to stop electing them and have someone else take over your country or not. So I think that would be an interesting thing to learn in the future if that played into their thought process. What do you think of Zelensky's performance and how he has acquitted himself on the world stage?
Well, let me answer a comment you made just a minute ago about how Putin perceives Zelensky. I do a lot of foreign news interviews, Sky News Arabia, Al Jazeera, Bloomberg, Al Shark, and they often have Russian professors and experts, and I've been debating with them. And I've just been amazed at these Russians who come on and call Zelensky a neo-Nazi who wanted to acquire nuclear weapons. He's a drug dealer. He's engaged in ethnic cleansing. And I'm just thinking, are these people all mad? Do they all believe these things that Putin's saying? Or maybe you have to say that to not be arrested if you do an international news media. I hate to call people I disagree with crazy, but when Putin runs around saying that Zelensky is a drug dealer or a drug addict, and I mean, we know the man is Jewish. He lost relatives in the Holocaust. To call him a neo-Nazi is so incredibly offensive. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I just want to lay that out there because there's a lot of weird stuff going on out of the Kremlin, out of Putin's supporters. I know conservatives who don't like Zelensky, and I was interviewed by one today who thinks he's too much of an opportunist and he's pushing his own agenda and trying to get the West involved in the war. I don't agree with that. I think this is a fairly heroic leader who is doing his best to save his people from a completely unjustifiable invasion by a much larger neighbor, completely unjustified. Is he trying to get the West involved? Of course he is, because he has nothing. He has no other alternative. When he's calling for a no-fly zone enforced by NATO, I don't blame him asking for that. I don't want NATO to do that because I don't want a NATO war with Russia.
Absolutely.
But I think Zelensky's doing the best he can. I admire him.
You know, the thing that I think I always become frustrated when people can't hold two thoughts in their head at the same time, you know, that Putin can be smart and evil, that Zelensky can be, pushing propaganda, but doing so in national interest, you know, that a nation can be full of corrupt government officials and oligarchs and the like, and yet still have great national pride and a willingness to defend itself. You know, these are all things that I think we should have the capacity to understand. And I think most people do understand them, but it seems like in cable news hits and the like, you could only say one of those things, you know, that you're only allowed to say one thing or the other. And if you combine the two, then that's a level of confusion that spawns. It frustrates me. And as someone who doesn't talk about foreign policy all the time, mostly is focused on domestic. Do you have that similar experience when you're trying to talk about a complex foreign policy situation?
I do. And there may be some angles of the story that I know and I'm not going to talk about because they're too complicated to get into and people would read it the wrong way. And I'll give you an example. Zelensky and the Ukrainian government are clearly engaged in their own propaganda efforts. I think a lot of the information we're getting on the number of Russian troops and equipment that are being destroyed by the Ukrainian government are probably inflated. I don't doubt they're making significant achievements in doing this, but it is in their interest to promote the morale of their people and to make it look like they're going to win to the West. You know, the Ukrainians who supposedly were killed on Snake Island, looks like they were taken prisoner, their POWs, but it was in the interest of the Ukrainian government to say that the Russians killed them all. I get that. That's what you do in warfare. It doesn't make the Ukrainian government evil. It's what you have to do to win.
You know, the other thing is, and I say this, I consider myself an old man at 40, but like having lived through a number of these war conversational cycles and the Arab Spring, it still, basically, I just always have my skeptical attitude whenever I see one of these things tweeted into my timeline or shared by people that could easily be sourced from Reddit or a photo that was taken years ago, repurposed for new efforts. Do you have any piece of advice that you give to many Americans who are interested in this, who care about it, who may have relatives on one side or another of it, about how they should interpret what they see on social media related to this conflict?
Well, I think when it comes to warfare, you have to treat everything with skepticism from both sides, because there is a propaganda war, an information war attached to a ground war, a war between troops. People want to keep the upper hand to, as I said, promote the morale of their people and of their soldiers and to attract international attention and to make the other side look bad. And whatever the Russians do, and they're doing terrible, terrible things, we can assume that the Ukrainians will put out propaganda that makes them even look worse. That's what they should do. They're outnumbered. And I just think that the internet is a great wasteland, and there's so much disinformation and fake news out there. And in warfare, at a time of war, I think it's even worse.
Fred, I'm going to ask you a broader question. The experience that I've had when it comes to foreign policy and national security is that having, coming from an army family and marrying into a Navy family is that the perspective of folks my age and younger is colored a lot by the failures of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, failures that can be assessed in a lot of different ways. But one thing that I think is unfortunate is how that argument has basically been used to suggest that America ought to not have anything to do when it comes to maintaining essentially the post-Cold War order around the world. To me, that's not just a conservative or a Republican idea. It's one that runs through back to the earliest days of the Monroe Doctrine and through Andrew Jackson. I mean, it's a foreign policy that was held by Calvin Coolidge and by Ike and by Ronald Reagan and by George H.W. Bush in terms of the respect for borders, the rule of law, and the way that we treat the authoritarians that exist within the world. I don't view that as fanciful neoconservative utopian dreams of a democratic Middle East, something that is, you know, that might be desirable, but seems impossible to achieve. And I feel like that's a distinction that is very difficult to make. What do you think about that frame of reference? And how do we get to a point where we understand that, you know, America's role in maintaining, you know, free shipping lanes, prosperity and peace around the world is not something that we should run away from, and that saying that doesn't make you an interventionist or a neoconservative necessarily in terms of what you're actually advocating for.
Well, I took a job with the America First Policy Institute last month. I've been here almost 2 months because I believe in this concept of America First, which is not isolationism. It is put in the interest of the American people and our economy and our worker first when making international decisions. That's either treaties or going to war. And it means using our forces wisely. We want a strong America. We want to use our military force when our interests are at risk. But we can't be the policemen of the world. The American people won't permit that anymore. We can't afford to do it. And I sadly don't think it was appropriate for us to send military forces into Turkey because Ukraine, because we did not have strategic interests there. Mm-hmm. I wish we could do that. I wouldn't have sent it even if the Russians weren't attacking. But we certainly don't want to send forces into an area where it could get the United States into a war with Russia, which could become a nuclear war. Mm-hmm. And I think the conservative movement is changing in light of what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan to try to choose carefully when we use military force to make sure it is in the interest of the American people, that we're not sending our soldiers for repeated tours of duty in these areas where we have no strategic interest. That you may not agree with me, but I think that's where the conservative movement has to go if it's going to survive.
I think you're correct about that. I mean, it's one of these things, though, that I think it's a very difficult distinction to make, because, you know, I saw the reaction to Senator Hawley's statement, for instance, about the Ukraine situation, and people were saying he was running away from, you know, his skepticism about putting troops on the ground. When I don't read it that way, I view it as being very consistent with putting Americans first, to want stability and to not want, you know, these types of incursions to happen. How can you strike that balance? And I understand that's a difficult thing to answer in just a minute or two.
And I want to add, I don't want to take our troops out of Korea. I don't want to take our troops out of Germany. I'm not an isolationist. This organization isn't either. But I think it takes enlightened leadership to weigh the costs and benefits of where we send our troops, what troop deployments we keep, and when do we just decide the time is up. I was pulling out of Afghanistan. I think we were there long enough, but I certainly didn't support the way Joe Biden withdrew. I think there was a way to withdraw wisely if the Taliban had kept its word on an agreement. But Biden simply wanted to get out to score political points to coincide with the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And he did enormous damage to the reputation of our nation as a credible and trustworthy country by what he did.
Fred, thank you so much for taking the time to walk us through all of this. I appreciate your insight.
Great to be here. Thanks, Ben.
We'll have my interview with John Davidson of The Federalist right after this. John Davidson is senior editor at The Federalist. John, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
So I wanted to run through a couple of the different interesting things that have stuck out to us in the early days of this Ukraine-Russia conflict. There was an article that was published by a certain news agency in Russia meant to celebrate a Russian victory and the collapse of Ukraine's government in terms of its, you know, it's one of these things that you pre-write, you know, it's like an obituary for Betty White or something like that, RIP.
Yeah.
You just have it in the can ready to go. And they accidentally pushed publish and it got grabbed up and looked at. It tells us a couple of things about what the Russians expected and what their motivations were. Walk us through that a little.
Well, one of the telling things was that the article was dated 26th of February. So it clearly indicates the timeline. And now I should say that this document is not a Kremlin document, but it clearly sort of reflects Kremlin thinking, or at least it sort of rhymes with what Putin had said before the invasion. But the timing on this, 48 hours after the initiation of Russian hostilities, suggests that Moscow thought this would be a very quick affair. They would insert a limited number of troops all across multiple fronts in Ukraine, and that President Zelensky's government would quickly collapse, and they would be able to install without a lot of heavy fighting, or bombardment of urban areas would be able to topple the Ukrainian state and impose a kind of puppet regime. That's certainly what the timeline suggests.
You know, I think that when we see that timeline, it has to have been based on a, whatever you can say about existing propaganda or spin or anything like that from either side, it has to have been based on an underestimation of the Ukrainian forces, of the kind of resistance that the Russians would run into, and of the effectiveness of their own approach, perhaps based on how easily they had advanced in 2014. What do you think about the way that things are going for the Russians at this point, just based on paying attention and on the trajectory that they're taking? And if this trajectory continues, what comes next? How does Russia double down effectively if their initial attempts don't achieve their aims with the speed and efficacy that they had intended?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that to that point you just raised, that their initial aims have not been successful. This has not gone the way that it seems Russia had planned for it to go. And that suggests to me that an adjustment is coming, a tactical adjustment. You know, when you listen to the military analysts, not the ones on TV, but the ones at obscure think tanks in Washington, D.C., who do this for a living, who are not making pronouncements about, imposing no-fly zones over Ukrainian airspace. When you listen to them, it becomes clear that the bulk of Russian forces have not been committed to this fight and are not even in Ukraine, and that the forces that are in Ukraine are strangely stretched out. You don't see them moving in tactical battalion groups. You see them scattered, tanks without infantry, infantry without tanks, and so on and so forth. You also don't see much use of Russian fixed-wing aircraft. You see helicopters, but you don't see the kind of air power that we know Russia has. So I think the adjustment that's coming, given that Ukraine has put up such a stiff resistance, and that Russia's initial plan for how this invasion would go has not panned out, is that there'll be an escalation, and there'll be heavy fighting in the cities. And the bulk of those Russian forces that have not been committed to the fight are going to get into the fight. And that may include, and I don't want to present myself as a sort of military tactician here. I'm repeating the things that I have been listening to, again, not on cable news, but but from people who study this for a living, is that the fighting will get heavier and it will get worse in the cities, and that the escalation on Russia's part is going to bring a lot of death and destruction to Ukraine. One thing I think that Russia wasn't counting on was this resistance from the Ukrainian people and its effect on the West, the provision of aid to Russia from NATO powers in Eastern Europe, and the support for Ukraine sort of across the Western world. In order to install a pro-Moscow regime in Ukraine, Russia needed to execute this war in a way that didn't sort of destroy Ukrainian cities. And I'm not sure they're going to be able to do that now.
Yeah, that's the thing that I think people are underestimating about the current dynamic. If you had this approach that was based on perhaps underestimating the Ukrainians and anticipating that they would fold rather easily, doubling down could make things look much worse for the Ukrainian people very fast. And I think that that's something that perhaps Western commentators are underestimating. I do appreciate, John, your audacity to come on the Fox News podcast and criticize cable news commentators. But I share your critique, which is that there's a real lack of seriousness among a lot of people. And when it comes to this type of thing, you want to listen to those nerds who pay attention to every cable and every release and every piece of information rather than the ones who play them on TV. I do think that it's going to be interesting what this looks like when it comes to that heavier hand. let's say that your prediction is true and that Putin starts to effectively level cities, you know, engage those fixed wing aircraft, drop bombs all over the place, et cetera. What is the Western response to that? What do you think happens next?
Unfortunately, I don't think that the Western, no matter how bad it gets in Ukraine, I don't see the Western powers being able to engage in a substantive way that changes sort of the brute facts on the ground. And I only say that because we've already seen their initial reluctance, but even now the kinds of things that we're seeing in terms of military aid coming to the Ukrainians, I don't know how effective that stuff is going to be. If, you know, it takes time to get, you know, high tech combat systems, you know, into a theater and functioning. Poland can commit, you know, fighters, you know, aircraft or artillery, but how is that going to make a difference in the interior of Ukraine and in some of these cities? Unfortunately, I think that the approach of the West is kind of to hope that these half measures and sanctions and, you know, being ostracized by the global community will somehow sway Putin and cause him to come to the negotiating table or to back off from his aims here. I don't think that you undertake what Putin has undertaken here unless you're willing and you've sort of already baked in those things into your analysis. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not optimistic about what this portends for the Ukrainians, just given the reality that Russia has sort of done a very large scale and what seems to be a kind of irreversible commitment to subjugating Ukraine. And I certainly don't see NATO intervening or the Western, you know, Western militaries intervening in a substantive way in the next, say, 2 weeks, which it'll have to be in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think you're correct about that. It would have to be in the next couple of weeks. And I don't see this moving quickly enough for that support to come together. However, one thing that we do definitely see happening is a coming together of NATO. The you know, the reversal of German policy when it comes to mm-hmm. paying their fair share, the debated interest among the Swedes and the Finns in terms of joining NATO. It seems that Vladimir Putin's incursion has solidified what was really kind of an archaic presentation, in the sense that NATO really hadn't done their fair share for a long time. It was obviously something that then candidate Trump, you know, emphasized significantly and continued as president to browbeat them over. Do you think that at the end of the day, the likeliest scenario is a Ukraine that is either dominated by Russia or perhaps has a rump, you know, region in the western part that they're able to hold on to, and that is then going to come into tension with perhaps a solidified and even expanded NATO?
Yeah, I'm hesitant to make predictions at this point, but I do agree with you that we sort of seen a hardening of NATO in recent days happen very quickly, and the reversal in Germany is really significant. I think that, you know, you and I would agree that NATO had kind of lost its way in recent years. Certainly the experience in Afghanistan had caused a lot of people in the United States and a lot of people on the right to question what the purpose of NATO and its current configuration was. And so to some extent that's been vindicated, but I think a lot of questions still remain about the future of NATO and what's going to happen now. Russia seems committed to the idea that Ukraine can never join NATO. And indeed, you know, loose talk about Ukraine joining NATO is partly to blame for the events that have transpired. That's not to put the blame on the West. It's just to say a certain amount of strategic, maybe miscalculation on the part of Western leaders over the year, vis-a-vis Russia's, what Russia was willing to do to prevent the expansion of NATO eastward. So I don't know what happens. I think that absent any kind of forceful intervention, or absent maybe a collapse of the Russian effort tactically, you are going to see portions of Ukraine sort of subsumed into Russia on a more or less permanent basis, as we saw in 2014 with Crimea. Mm-hmm. As for the rest of it, boy, I don't know. We're just going to have to wait and see what happens. It's so dynamic. It's crazy to think that this has only been going on for 4 days, 5 days now.
Mm-hmm. There is a lot of I think early predictions being made that are not justified. But one point of comparison that I would make, and I do not believe it to be irresponsible, is that you and I both were watching the news and paying heavy attention to it during the initial assaults in the war in Iraq, a war of the United States' own choosing, a preemptive war made the case for on the international stage under the basis of weapons of mass destruction. This, similarly, in the case of Putin, is a preemptive war, presumably designed to prevent the expansion of NATO, designed to take a stand against a foe that they say is full of poison and neo-Nazis and drug users and the like. And obviously the United States had enormous initial success, followed by a extended, bloody, and costly period of being mired in wars of conflict with guerrillas and support from within the country that percolated up and created major problems. Is there a risk for Russia that they could win this war, but at the same time experience a Ukraine that becomes their own personal version of Iraq?
I think so. The determination of Ukrainian citizens to resist the Russian invasion, the willingness for ordinary people to kind of take up arms, recognizing that some of that is, of course, info ops and propaganda on the Ukrainian side, is striking nevertheless. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a possibility that Russia finds itself in an insurgency type of situation like you describe. Now, the United States, because of our economic might and our military power, were able to undertake that kind of adventure in Iraq and see it through for years and years and sort of turn it around with the surge, not without terrible costs, of course, and not without a political change of administrations that saw us abandon Iraq and then have to go back, right? I think most people in America now agree the Iraq war was a debacle, but Russia simply can't sustain that kind of protracted insurgency of the kind that we saw with the U.S., experience in Iraq. And so I don't know what the Russian response will be to an insurgency, but I don't think we're going to see this protracted years long sort of investment and occupation mm-hmm. of hostile areas in Ukraine by the regular Russian army. Whatever it is that comes out of this is not going to be a replay of the US in Iraq or the US in Afghanistan for that matter.
That mm-hmm. It is something I agree they cannot afford to do. John Davidson, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks, Ben.
There's a story related to the developments in Ukraine that I think should receive a little bit more consideration in light of what we know about a different story that took the front pages and obviously a lot of attention from Fox News Channel in the run-up to the 2020 election, something that was unfortunately squashed in a lot of different ways by big tech and by other powers that be within the establishment of our media, our corporations, and those corrupt actors who came out of a lot of prior administrations. And that's the Hunter Biden story. Now, obviously there are aspects of this story that I believe are overblown or inaccurate in terms of the attitude of Hunter Biden toward various entities. It's certainly possible for the son of a then vice president, interim former vice president, and then presidential candidate in Joe Biden that he could be involved in or not involved in, you know, and that's often something that either we don't have the proof to say definitively, or there are signs in one direction or another, but perhaps not the definitive proof needed to say how involved Joe Biden was in what Hunter was doing. But I do think, having said all that, that there is certainly enough proof to raise those questions, to have those questions be justified, to demand answers of them while Joe Biden was a candidate before he ever stood for election to the presidency of the United States. These questions come to the fore now in particular because of the activity in Ukraine, an area where obviously Hunter Biden's activities were viewed with such skepticism and such potential corruption that there was interest on the part of the Trump team, Donald Trump himself, and those around him in investigating this and in driving further investigation of it, something that ultimately led to a backlash from the bureaucratic administrative state in the person of Alexander Vindman and the quote-unquote whistleblower that ultimately led to the president's impeachment. This was a ridiculous scenario. And stepping back, in case you haven't heard me say it before, the idea that the president of the United States could be impeached over essentially disagreeing with what the assigned bureaucratic agenda was, the predetermined administrative cooperative agenda and the like, is absurd and completely backwards. The president of the United States sets our foreign policy. The buck stops here. It means something. Whether that was wise or not on the president's part is a separate question, a political one. And there, I'm more sympathetic to the idea that there was little to be gained. However, one of the scenarios that now confronts us is the realization that to the degree there is any compromising material in Ukraine, that it exists in on servers in Kyiv or the background files of various officials within the Ukrainian government, if the Russians didn't have it already, they'll have it soon enough. This is a terribly and depressing moment, and should be a depressing moment for any American who does not want to see a president compromised by a foreign power. This is obviously something that was said over and over again about Donald Trump when he was president. It was ridiculous. Then his plaudits for various authoritarians around the world, notwithstanding, I do think you would have to believe, given the way that he throws out both compliments and insults, that the level of compromising material, quote unquote, compromat, that is used against him is something that would have to be, absolutely obscene to be believed. It just simply is not the case. That's not the way this worked. There's no proof of it. And ultimately, the Russia hoax turned out to be lies all the way down. What we do know, however, is that Hunter Biden participated in a way that clearly was not justified in the board of a company that had all manner of activity, questionable activity in a particularly corrupt part of the world in Ukraine. And we should understand that the kind of material that could come out of this could be used by Russia against President Biden in ways that could absolutely have a political impact. We don't know what the Russians know about the Hunter Biden arrangements. We don't know what they might claim to know about Joe Biden's role within such arrangements. We don't know what they might use to invent such arrangements, meaning that they have some aspects of compromising material that are real and that they combine it with other material that is false. The financial gain that flowed through or adjacent to this Ukrainian regime is something that could absolutely be used by Russia in the future for political purpose in the Western media. And that's something that I think we should all be aware of, have our eyes open to. We've seen the way that the potential salacious material coming from foreign sources was used under the Hillary Clinton campaign. And we've seen the way that it has colored our politics for years with massive ramifications. That type of playbook can and will be tried again. The question is, who is going to try it and what will they use to do it? We should be aware that it might be Russia this time around. I'm Ben Domenech. You are listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.